South African gold miners face the highest rates of TB in the world, 7,000 cases per 100,000 people, or 1,400 times the rate of TB that exists in developed countries like Canada. Over 98% of mine workers never receive compensation for the lung disease they acquire while working on the job. And yet, as our guest on today's episode of Health Justice Radio, Jonathan Smith, has found, these shocking numbers have done regrettably little to change the fate of South African mine workers. The workers contract TB, often multi-drug-resistant TB, in the mines and then travel back to their small communities without access to healthcare. TB literally follows them home. Jonathan Smith, then a graduate student at Yale University in the Department of Epidemiology, went to South Africa to research HIV, TB, and mining. He discovered quickly that not every public health disaster can be described in numbers. On today's episode of the Health Justice Radio Collective, we speak with him.
Listening to Health Justice Radio Collective on CFMU 93.3.
Hi, Jonathan. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me on here.
So we just heard the statistics about rates of TB in South Africa. Tell me about why that country is particularly affected.
So that's... That's quite a large question. There's a number of factors as to why TB and HIV is so particularly bad in South Africa specifically. It has a number of legal, sociological, historical, and physiological contexts. Primarily, physiologically, I think it's important to understand that that these mines produce TB and HIV at rates much, much higher than the regular population because of the circumstances in which the mine workers work. So they're working underground at about 3 to 4 miles up underground, about 6 kilometers. And they oftentimes don't have proper ventilation and things like that. And specifically in South Africa, in the ore in South Africa, you find silica dust much higher than even gold mines in other areas of the world. So you find the silica dust and the mine workers breathe it in, and with poor ventilation that deep underground, the silica dust enters the lungs, and it actually doesn't do what a lot of people think. A lot of people think that it lacerates the lung epithelium. What it actually does is it's so fine it gets engulfed by the alveolar macrophage,
mm-hmm.
and that, so since it's engulfing an inorganic crystal, it renders that macrophage useless. And so the lung's immune defense is no longer, apt to fight any kind of entering pathogen. And when you have tuberculosis circling in there, it is a great predisposition to tuberculosis. Then on top of that, if you have HIV in the mind, which have very high rates of HIV, that further complicates the immune system, much in the same way that silicosis does. So when you have those two things combined, you actually have a multiplicative effect of risk of tuberculosis. So it's about 15 times higher than the general population. So physiologically, these two diseases really work in tandem to create a really exquisitely susceptible host to tuberculosis.
Mm-hmm.
HIV in the mines is largely fostered by the migrant work that's done by the mines. The mines is over 90% migrant work, and so they're able to, they're not able to bring their families with them. There's no family-style living conditions, and there's also hostel-style living conditions. So they live in 20 to 30 men per hostel. So their only choice for intimacy is typically sex work, and so you see rates of infection, of HIV infection, upwards of 70% in the mining communities, in some mining communities. So there was an interesting statistic by the Deloitte mining, by the Deloitte audit company that showed that 1 in 3 mine workers will develop HIV within 18 months of working on the mind. So there really is a direct correlation between that. So all of that combined physiologically creates a really, really good just source of disease. And then, like you said in the introduction, that in most of these men are migrant workers that, that take these diseases home to small areas of South Africa that and Southern Africa as a whole that have generally no access to health care.
Mm-hmm.
So that's physiologically. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, so, I mean, you'd think that maybe a mining company might be inclined to worry about the health of their workers, you know, if this kind of thing stopped their production lines. But in this case, it seems like there's such a great pool of labor that really doesn't really matter to them if their workers die.
Exactly. So it's so I just described it through a physiological prism. I guess if you look through an economic prism, rates of unemployment in South Africa and Southern Africa as a whole they're astronomical. And so what we have is this perpetuated cycle of poverty. So it's much cheaper for mine workers to be sent home from the mine. And I think there's a legal complication that allows that to go on with no accountability for the mine for their health care. So economically, if you have 10 people looking for the same job in a mine, then it's much quicker and less complicated to let someone go and hire a new worker, since there's no real economic incentive for the organization as a whole to put in the preventative measures or the post-infection treatment that would be needed to actually treat the workers properly.
Mm-hmm. So when people come to the mine, do they know about the health sequelae they're likely to face?
So that's actually a really good question. I went and stayed with several mine workers throughout this journey, and one of the mine workers, as I was filming, I was asking him over and over repeatedly. He was telling me about how he had gotten tuberculosis, came home, recovered and gone back to the mine knowing that he was going to get tuberculosis. And this personal cycle happened three or four times. And I kept asking him, if you knew you were sick, why are you going back if you keep knowing that you're sick? And he just kept saying, you know, I don't have any other choice. And this kind of question and answer went back and forth. And finally, he just looked at me and kind of put me in my place and said, Jonathan, we don't have any other choice. I know I'm going to get sick. I know I'm going to get injured, but what other choice do I have? I have to feed my family. So that was one of the times where I was really, I really understood that they do not have any other choice, and that's something very difficult for, I think, a lot of people in Western society to understand, because to not have a choice, we always feel like we in some way have some other choice. But his reiteration was that there is literally no other choice that they have except to go work at the mines.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, they do know that there's risk. There's not proper education systems to let them know exactly how and why that there's a risk. And almost every mine worker that I spoke with did say, I don't know how you get tuberculosis. I don't know if it's caused by this or that. I just know that I get it.
Mm-hmm.
So they do know that they get it. They don't necessarily know how and why, and that's an educational problem
mm-hmm.
as well.
And this isn't only, a certain generation. This happens generation after generation, right?
Right. So there was a famous quote that was in 1903 that said that the extent to which miners' tuberculosis prevails at the present time is so great that preventative measures are an urgent necessity, and that such a large number of sufferers in our midst is a matter of keen regret. And that was, again, written in 1903, which was well over a century ago. And since then, there's been other equally damning quotes. There was, in 1996, there was a Leon Commission report that said the failure to control tuberculosis in the mining industry is a matter of grave concern. And then in 2008, they did another report that says again and again that this is a problem and we need to address it. So the problem is actually changing those reports into actual change, and there's been very little change over the past decade. And if you look at the statistics from today, and if you look at the statistics from a century ago, you see that they're generally the same in regards to silicosis, and only increased in tuberculosis, and that's because of the recent introduction of HIV. So throughout this century of rhetoric, I suppose, has been mirrored by a decline in action and an increase in disease.
Mm-hmm. So I guess an element of what you experienced when you went to South Africa was this frustration at inaction. Because as you say, the problem has been described for over a century. And you decided to do something a little bit different. I wonder if you can tell us about that project.
Sure. So I first decided to do a research project on this that would look at where mine workers came from and their impact in their individual communities after they were sent home with tuberculosis. In designing that project, in designing that research project, I got a response from the National Union of Mine Workers that said that we'll be happy to help you with your research study, but just so you know, mine workers have been used for guinea pigs. I feel like they've been used for guinea pigs because there's been so much research done on the population. And to clarify what that means is there has been such a sea of research done on the population that research now in the mining community is not specifically for the mining community, but researchers understand that mine workers in South Africa are so exquisitely primed to get these two diseases that they can use them for their research study, their cohort study, a cohort study, because they know that they have a high likelihood of getting disease. So they can literally be used, they have literally been used as a guinea pig population to study TB and HIV in other contexts. And to me, that, especially in an industry and in a government that's competent enough to rectify the situation, that seemed to make absolutely no sense to me. So one thing that hasn't been done is to actually find what, in all of this discussion, in the century of discussion, and everyone always talks about the mine worker sent home, the mine worker, but no one's actually ever gone to find the mine workers themselves. So that's when I decided to get a camera and some basic filming equipment, and I went off to South Africa and lived with four former mine workers that were co-infected with TB and HIV for several weeks, 6 weeks. And I was able to live with them. We did everything I slept in the same community family bed with them. And they let me film their daily life. And I really got to know the individual that was a victim of this larger process. And now I'm turning that into a documentary film.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think that this film will be different than all the other research?
So hopefully in the attempt that I'm trying, the angle that I'm trying to take with the film is that it hopefully will cut through a lot of the politics. It'll cut through a lot of the pointing fingers and whose fault it is, and get to the person that's affected. And in a way that doesn't portray their death necessarily, because fortunately for me in this case, I'm not a filmmaker, so I know what movies I like and don't like, and I don't particularly like movies that are about death and disease. That would be depressing. So the angle that I'm taking with the film is to portray the life of the mine workers. And even though all the mine workers that didn't have access to care did pass away, the film really focuses on their family life, and kind of brings to light that there are people behind this process. And like you said in the introduction, that we can no longer look at public health statistics as a gain or loss of numbers. We need to look at them as individuals, and that's what I hope this film does.
So you said this isn't about blame, but surely the mining companies have some responsibility.
Yes, yes. There is a what I like to call a web of complacency throughout a lot of industries. So to be clear, it's very easy to point the finger at the mining industry in this, and that finger should definitely strongly be pointed at the mining industry. They have a storied history of non-compliance, and even in the latest presidential audit from the South African president commissioned an audit report, and in that audit report it says that and I can read the exact quote. It says the failure to maintain regulatory standards in the mines has been a complete failure. And then they go on to state, just one second, inquiry after inquiry makes findings to the effect that risk assessments are not conducted, training is not done, early morning examinations are not done, equipment's not maintained, and the list goes on and on. And that's their actual phrasing, the list goes on and on. So there is a large finger to be pointed at the mining industry. But then if you look at the government, the South African government, and the government of the Swaziland, Lesotho, Mozambique, the surrounding governments, mm-hmm. they've done very little to enforce these regulations on the mining industry. And you can actually, a recent study showed that of auditors for the governmental auditors for the mining industry, when checked, only one in three were actually at their post doing the audit when they did a surprise check on them. So if a government is only getting a third of the audits done, and the audits are bad, then that, you know, shifts not all the blame on the mining industry, but the government itself. And then if you look at the union has a role in of this complacency, in that they are supposed to be fighting for the mine workers. They're supposed to say, this is a problem, and we need to stop it. And this problem of continuation of care for the mine workers has been going on for so long. And the unions themselves has done very little to actually try to solve this problem.
Mm-hmm. Maybe I was just going to say it might be nice to talk about TB treatment and what that involves, just in terms of its longevity, in order to explain to people, you know, how TB treatment happens. And I mean, it has been carried out successfully in low resource settings, but it's not an easy endeavor.
Right. So TB treatment is actually quite arduous. The bacilli itself is a pretty tough bug to crack, and because of it has a very tough outer shell, and because of that, you have to use a combination of four drugs that kind of attack different things to kind of get through the armor of this bacteria. So it's in physiologically quite a tough bacteria to crack. So the drugs is typically four drugs for 2 months at 7 days a week, and then two drugs for four more months at 5 days a week. So you can imagine that that's quite a complex drug regimen for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not something that's, you know, something that you can treat for a week and it's cured, like a lot of other types of diseases. You know, it's not a standard course of antibiotics. So therein lies the problem. You're very sick and you're out of commission for quite some time. And so mines will oftentimes try to treat mine workers initially, see if they get better and if they're able to work. If they don't get better, then they're legally deemed unfit to work and their contract is terminated. So maybe a month or two in, their contract will be terminated and they're left to go back home. When they go home, there's no continuation of care. So they have the first few months of treatment, and then they go home with no continuation of care, no access to care. And that's really where the problem lies, because now they're at home, they have, they're not cured of TB. They get home and then they have a reinfection of TB, and then they have no access to care. Mm-hmm. So it's really one of the main problems is this continuation of care and actually getting the mine workers care at their homes. And like you said, it's a very difficult treatment, and it's not something that is easily deliverable to the home. And, you know, if in low resource settings and other situations, if you make the trip to the clinic once, it's difficult enough. If you have to make that trip to the clinic once a month for 6 months, that's virtually impossible in many of these settings. And that's why tuberculosis is particularly difficult in this situation.
Mm-hmm. So in your film, who are you calling on to take action?
So the point of the film is to call on both civil society and policymakers to take action. What I think is the underlying problem in all of this, in the mines themselves, the government, the unions, and the researchers themselves, who are using this population as a guinea pig, it's really calling on civil society to place accountability on all of those bodies to say, we know about this situation now. There's been a just a pervasive sense of no accountability whatsoever. So in this trifecta of the industry, the government, and the union, if no one is a watchdog, then they allow this to perpetuate and to worsen. So the film has kind of two branches. It's to be widely available to the public so that they're aware of the situation. And by creating awareness, we can place accountability on the industry as a whole, and the situation as a whole. And it's also to show to the academic realm, to the people that make the decisions, the decision-making power, to show them and say, this is a problem. Civil society now knows about it, and now we're watching you to make sure that you do something. Throughout history, there's been peaks of political movements to change the issue, such as this. In 2008, an organization called the AIDS and Rights Alliance of Southern Africa brought together some people from South Africa, some people from Lesotho, and they really advocated for some cross-border management of these mine workers that were going between the two countries. They drafted some excellent policies, and then no one was there to watch to make sure that the governments actually went through with it. And so it kind of fizzled out. So now what the film hopes to act as a constant reminder that we're watching, and that when policies are drafted and when policies are made, that they need to be carried out in full and appropriately.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this sounds like one of the problems you've seen is kind of this, I guess, a problem of research ethics in this case. I wonder, do you think that this extends farther than the realm of HIV-TB? Are researchers in other areas also kind of stuck in this inaction circle?
I think so. I think that's a very good point, and that's a personal belief that I have, that I think a lot of people in research don't connect what their research is to the people that they're researching. So I think a lot of them, I think a lot of us, and I think a lot of people that do research fail to recognize that their research actually carries a lot of significance in the areas in which they're researching. And so to me personally, I feel that if you're going to research something, then you should be an advocate for change in that area. So if you're not an advocate for change in the area that you're researching, then you probably shouldn't be researching it. And I'm finding now less and less that you find people that do research and have very strong epidemiological data or clinical data that says this is a problem and this is what should be done to do it. And there's very little follow-up to actually ensure that that's done. So to me, I often pose the question of what is the point of public health research if there's no public health benefit? I strongly believe that if you're going to research something, you should be an advocate for change in that area. And that's not always the case. And I think it's in a number of situations. And so, yeah, I think it's a problem.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, that's not to say that the research isn't important, and that's not to say that everyone that researches and produces things is you know, just doing it for no reason. There's actually quite a very valid argument to the point of ongoing statistical and epidemiological research that will highlight the point and then pass that on to other people that can make a change. So I want to be clear that I'm not saying that every researcher should go out and do some sort of fanatical thing to radically change what issue that they're researching.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell us what stage your film is at right now?
So the film was primarily filmed throughout the course of 2010 and 2011, and now after graduation, I'm here working in post-production. I'm working with several filmmakers and storytellers that are constructing a storyline in post-production that will really bring out the humanity side of disease and the humanistic side of this entire argument, and kind of veer away from the political and argumentative side of this, and just kind of get down to the point. So right now we're in the post-production phase of the documentary.
Mm-hmm. And do you want to tell us how people can help out if they're interested?
Currently, right now, the film is doing what we call a Kickstarter campaign to get some Kickstarter funds to help with this post-production. So with the successful completion of the Kickstarter campaign, we can do about 95% of the work on the film. And that is, the website for that is kickstarter.com. And if you type in the title of the film is They Go to Die. And if you type that into the search, then you can be able to find much more about the film and the Kickstarter campaign. The film itself has a website, www.theygotodie.com, that people can go to too. And there's more information about the issue in the film there, as well as a link to the Kickstarter page. So at the moment, we have a financial hurdle that we're trying to overcome. But more importantly, as this hurdle is overcame, in whatever capacity we overcome it, the important thing is that the film really hopes to thread individuals and organizations together to form a cohesive unit to place this accountability to which I spoke about. So more important than financially contributing would be a large body of individuals and supporting organizations that want to help and want to voice their opinion for change and place their place their level of accountability on this issue, and to do that, they can send me an email and I can sign them up on the partners' email listserv, and we can, when needed and when we need to mobilize on this issue, they're readily available and willing to help.
Okay, well, that's all the time we have today. Thank you so much, Jonathan, for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me.
Great. Thanks.